when last tape ended, you were talking about the volumes that you sold of Lashing Out.
Yeah, well, I figured 2,000 copies would go fairly fast. Mm-hmm. And I made arrangements with several of the bookstores to have signing affairs, and they'd lay on cookies and pop and that kind of thing and advertise it in the paper. And I managed to sell a few that way. But that, if you ever write a book and you go to a signing, prepare to be disappointed at the number of people who show up. Because I think other people have told me they had the same experience. Mm-hmm. And then, I had the idea that alumni might be interested in it, because it would remind them of the years. The book spans from, 71 to 82 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that would remind them of what was going on when they were here, you know. So I went to the editor of the alumni magazine and I said, how about letting me make use of the membership list? I figured 30,000 members or something of the Alumni Association. Could I use that to mail out advertisements for the book? So he checked with somebody. They said, no, if we do that for you, then every other faculty member is going to want it. You know, you can imagine how I reacted to mm-hmm. that. Anyway, I said, how about taking out an ad in the magazine? I think a damned ad cost them like $700, a full page in the back. Mm-hmm. And I wrote the ad and whatnot. And, well, when I first was trying to sell the book through the bookstores, I don't know why I hit upon a price of $4.95. I just pulled it out of thin air, you know. I thought, well, alumni can pay more than that. So I think I said, you get the book at an alumni discount at $6.95. And I'll eat the charges. Shipping and handling. Yeah. Well, I lost about $300. No, I think the damned ad cost $1,000.
Yeah.
And I got back $700 in sales.
I see. So publishing entrepreneur is not part of your...
No, God knows it. Yeah. I made a good decision when I decided not to go into business.
Could we talk a little bit about teaching? A lot of the interviews that we've done so far have been with administrators, and we're just starting now to branch out into faculty and instructors. And I'd like to talk a little bit about your philosophy of teaching and how you approached the task of being a teacher. Was there any favorite technique or that you used when you approached teaching your classes?
You know, I don't really know how to answer that, but I'll just rattle off some things that occur to me. When I first got here, the econ department was suffering from an inadequate supply of students. We never did have many majors in econ. We had tremendous teaching responsibilities, but these were required courses for all business students. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, beginning econ is required in fields like engineering and all around the campus. So we had large classes and thousands of students, but we didn't have very many majors. And there was some feeling that maybe some of the members of the department could improve their teaching skills. So President Hanna had invited a man, I think his name was George S. Counts, C-O-U-N-T-S, who had been on the faculty at University of Columbia Teachers College and had retired, and was well known. If you read articles about college teaching, you'd see, in those days, you'd see this man's name. So Hanna had brought him out here to be a consultant to the president on teaching methods. So we invited him to conduct a seminar for the members of our department on how to be an effective teacher. Well, I don't think any of us really learned much from that, which it may be a commentary on us for all I know. But see, you ask the question, what's a good teacher? Well, the answer, has always seemed to me, is you might be a good teacher doing it the way you do it. I might be a good teacher doing it a different way. For example, Adams taught using what he called the Socratic method. He would grill students on the passages in the book that he was using. And he would just really come down hard on them. And women students would burst into tears and so on. And he thought that was great. And sometimes it does put a student in a position where he or she is more attentive because you might be called on or reads the book more carefully. It can have that effect. And he was considered, I think he won some kind of an award as Teacher of the Year nationally. Mm. Appeared in Rolling Stone magazine. Mm-hmm. and now I could not use that method mm-hmm. because it embarrasses people. And I figure I want to make the class sufficiently interesting and with luck enjoyable that people will want to come to class. And so, see, I had three different courses that I taught time after time. Beginning economics, which is for freshmen and sophomores. And it was always a huge class, anywhere from 250 to finally 608 in B-108 Wells Hall.
608.
Once or twice. Where it's just a lecture. That's about the only way I could handle a big class like that. And then labor economics, which was a junior level class, where I would have in Erickson Kiva, for example, a couple hundred or 300 or something like that. And then I had a class in labor law in which I used the same case book that people at Harvard or various other places in law school use. And in labor law, I would announce at the beginning, or put it in the syllabus, 30% of the grade is going to turn on how well you perform in class, which means you'd be called upon to... You ever watch Paper Chase?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, see, that was sort of my model, in a way, for the labor law. Mm-hmm. So you have to teach these differently. You can't teach the same way in a 400-student auditorium that you can with, say, 35, if you can manage to keep it to that size in labor law. Mm-hmm. But, I guess it wouldn't be too much to say crushed when I read Grebner's Grading the Profs. He was in one of my classes one time.
He was a former student?
Mm-hmm.
Mark Grebner?
Yeah, Mark.
Grading the Profs.
Grading the Profs. Of me, he said, poor lecturer. Oh, that really hurts. Because I would have people who would sit in on that class three times in a row sometimes, just to listen to me go on about labor relations and the history of unions and et cetera. And so I saw myself as a kind of storyteller. Mm-hmm. And the students would complain sometimes on evaluations in labor economics. They'd say you go off on too many tangents. Well, their idea of a tangent was my idea of an anecdote or an incident in some detail that would illustrate some general concept I was trying to explain. Now, in the beginning of macro, or either macro or micro, for the freshmen and sophomores, I would follow the textbook carefully, and I would try to rephrase in my own way, however these concepts of demand and supply and, you know, all those things. And I kept rewriting my lecture notes every time I taught it to try to make as clear as I possibly could what some of these terms meant. How could you define them? So that's one approach I took there. I saw myself as not as a storyteller so much, but as explaining, mm-hmm. explicating, I guess is mm-hmm. the word. But in labor, the approach I took in labor economics was, if you're going to try to understand why unions behave the way they do in the year 2000, it's pretty useful to know how they got the way they are, what their history was all about. Mm-hmm. So the students called the class labor history. See, I called it labor relations.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, I could see why they would call it labor history. Mm-hmm. And I would do a lot of research into the history of unions. I used to have... Oh, I'd spend maybe a couple of weeks on how the Teamsters got to be corrupt and the effect of prohibition on the corruption of labor unions in certain fields of activity, you know, the clothing industry, the produce markets in New York, Mm-hmm. And so on, where you have a perishable product, which means a union has the employer over a barrel. You can't let a shutdown occur. Mm-hmm. Could you lose too much money? Mm-hmm. I'd raise the question, why is it that coal miners seem to be prone to violence and strikes where they blow up mines and whatnot? See, and I had an explanation for that.
What was that?
Well, I'd put it this way. If you, as a matter of your employment, have to provide your own dynamite to blast the face of the coal seam, then when you get into a strike, it sort of comes naturally to blow up a building. Yeah. Your mine entrance.
You're going to have that expertise.
I said, by contrast, suppose I get sore at the administration. I'm not going to go over and try to blow up the ad building, much as I might like to, because I don't work with dynamite all the time, and I'd probably blow myself up instead of the administration.
Mm-hmm. did you bring any guest speakers in? Did you ever do that? Or
once in a while I would. And I don't know whether I stopped doing it because people in their evaluations would say we should have more speakers. Or why it was. But once in a while I would. Once in a while a student would say, my dad is a Teamster, and why don't you invite him to talk to the class and he can tell all about what it's like to be. This is when the Teamsters Union was corrupt. Mm-hmm. So I'd invite dad and mom and brother and sister would show up. Mm-hmm. And then the old man would spend his time talking about how your kidneys are adversely affected by bouncing in the seat of one of these
trucks.
Yeah. Instead of talking about the movement to try to throw out the rascals in the leadership. Mm-hmm. So it didn't work out too well. Mm-hmm. But I felt, I still feel this way, that in a subject like that, where in effect telling these stories and going over the struggles in labor management relations and so on, by implication, I think I was urging them to stand up for their rights and whatnot. And I figured if I'm doing that, then I should behave that way myself. So I figured dressing the way this in this what you say, eccentric fashion, getting into supporting students who were in difficulties with the administration and young faculty and so on, and writing in the paper. It was all part of what I considered to be teaching. So I felt I was teaching on and out, in and out of the classroom, and trying to make everything consistent. Now, some guy, every once in a while, somebody in psychology would assign students to interview a member of the faculty to decide, are they happy at what they're doing, and is there a consistency between the way they behave and what they teach and so on. And I remember one of these profs, I can't remember who he was now, calling me up after some of the students had interviewed me for his class that way. And he said, you know, I always thought you were just crazy, but he said, I realize now all of these things you do were perfectly consistent, from your standpoint anyway. Mm-hmm. I felt pretty good about that.
Yeah. There was a thoughtful analysis behind it.
Well, it was consistent with what I was trying to do anyway.
Well, it's interesting, the idea of you're listening to students and what directions they were headed.
Yeah.
Almost like a counselor almost.
I always wanted to teach... deal with students as if they were adults. I never said kiddies or kids or something, the way a lot of faculty do. Mm-hmm. And I never thought I was all that much smarter than they were. I couldn't have proved it if I thought that. And I think they must have sensed that.
In the course of your career, you spanned quite a few presidents or provosts and that sort of thing. Yeah. And in the direction you've already mentioned Dr. Hanna at length, could we talk a little bit about some of the other presidents that you worked with?
I thought it was fun to poke fun at Hanna when he acted in a way I didn't approve of. Did I mention that thing about some guy who was working on a dictionary?
No, I don't think so.
I don't know what Hanna did, but it was before I started writing columns. It might have been my accusation that he was red-baiting those three communist-trained agitators or something, I went to the AAUP, which I didn't belong to, and went to a meeting, and I offered a motion of censure of Hanna for whatever he said. And before I did, I went to my unabridged dictionary and I looked up censure, criticize, you know, etc. I wanted just the shade of meaning that I wanted the motion to convey. So I think we used the word censure. Well, there was some guy in the group there, whom I didn't know, who wanted to put a friendly amendment on the one I proposed. And I can't remember what word he wanted, but he wanted some other word. No, I said, I absolutely insist on censure. That I looked that up. And I think I even had written down the shades of meaning of the different words that would be synonyms. So he backed off, and the thing went through the way I proposed it. I found out the next day, he was a guy named Fred Reeves, who was in the English department, and he was working for some dictionary outfit on a new dictionary. Oh God, I was embarrassed when I found that out. But anyway, this motion, which was a pretty sharp criticism of Hanna, was adopted. But the next day, the top leaders of the branch got together and rescinded the motion, so it never saw the day, light of day. But anyway, I think I mentioned that despite taking pot shots from time, well, not just pot shots, if you were instrumental in hauling the university into federal court and they're embarrassed the way they were, they're entitled to think you're the kind of guy they'd like to see at some other institution. Mm-hmm. So I took a few pot shots at him in points of view in those days. But I think I mentioned the other day when he left in 69, he said, as he was, you know, I was going through the line saying goodbye to him, he said, you and I disagreed on several issues, but I always knew you had the best interests of Michigan State at heart. So as the years go by, I think back on him increasingly in a positive way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy was a tremendous leader. I used to say he was the Henry Ford of higher education. Mm-hmm. See, I think of him as taking the faculty right after World War II by the scruff of the neck and over their objections, making this a university instead of a cow college. Mm-hmm. So you'd never get the kind of changes that converted us into a university out of faculty, which troubled me because here I was campaigning when I could for more faculty participation in affairs. Now we have a tremendous amount of faculty participation, committees for this and committees for that. I don't think it has changed the way the place is run one damn bit.
Mm-hmm. You'd call them a benevolent dictator?
I would call
them a benevolent dictator. In other areas, but...
Yeah, he never... Now, see, he used to know every member of the faculty, and that was another parallel I saw between him and Henry Ford in the early days. Mm-hmm. So he would get the recommendations for salary increases, and he would go down the list, and he would see somebody's name there who was recommended, let's say, for a modest increase, and Hanna thought he was making a better contribution than that, and he'd scratch out the amount and increase it. And then the same thing would happen with some guy who was a troublemaker, like this guy Jaffe. See, Jaffe did something that I thought was really great. He was called over to the president's office one time when the president had been going down this salary list that recommended salary increases. And he said, Professor Jaffe, you're not getting much of an increase here. You're aware of that, aren't you? And Jaffe said, yeah. And he said, you know, if you just quit carping and criticizing, you'd get a better salary increase than you're getting. So Jaffe says, how big an increase? He told him. And see, in those days, a big increase would be $500. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he told him 400 or something. Jaffe's just not worth it.
Not worth it.
I used to tell people that, a variant of that. I'd say, people would say to me, Are you, being when the salary list came out, they could see I had a modest salary, as economists go. And they would say, is your salary held down because you write these columns and you do these things? I said, I don't think so. I have no evidence of that. I know I'd have a better salary if I published more, if I were could write faster and do research faster and write articles instead of taking 11 years to get out a book or something. So I know what I have to do to get a salary increase. I just don't feel like doing it. I like doing what I'm doing. But I said, suppose I were punished by, let's say, instead of getting a salary increase of $500, I get a salary increase of $250 or whatever it is. Think of it this way. What is that difference after taxes? And then divide it by 12. So what is the difference month by month? And it's going to come out $25-$30. Hell, I put that under the heading of entertainment.
Entertainment.
And that's true, you know, the difference between the salary you get if you kept your mouth shut and what you get if you sound off, the difference isn't very damn much. Nowadays, it isn't much either, is it?
No, not often. How did Clifton Wharton respond to your the columns? Obviously, you started writing the columns on a regular basis.
I was going full steam ahead because he came in 1970. Mm-hmm. Oh no, I wasn't. I was still writing Points of View in 1970.
Okay.
But I was really hard on Wharton. Mm-hmm. He would give a speech or somewhere in which he would criticize the faculty without identifying who it was or whatever, or he'd make a statement that I couldn't figure out. I couldn't understand what he was saying, and I'd ask people, what do you mean by that statement that I've read in the State News? He'd say, I don't know. So I remember writing I found out later he had a speech writer who had been a reporter for one of the Detroit papers, a guy named Bob Perrin. Perrin wrote the speeches, and evidently Wharton gave them. So I opened a column one time. I said, every time our new Prexy, he was always our new Prexy, for 8 years.
8 years.
Every time he gives a speech, my mail bag is bulging with letters. Pompous windbag is a typical comment. Now that's a nasty thing to say about somebody. But he never complained about that. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was friendly to me. Mm-hmm. Now, we did have one situation there where his distaste for me came through, and that was we needed a new faculty grievance officer. A guy named Harrison in chemistry had been the first one, and then a guy named Bruce Miller in philosophy mm-hmm. followed him. And Bruce, I think, left the position after 3 years to become department head of philosophy, something like that. So the position was open. Well, the University Committee on Faculty Affairs has supervisory authority over the grievance procedure. And when there's a vacancy in the office, their responsibility is to recommend somebody to the president. And I think the way the grievance procedure reads, recommend one person. So they were setting about looking at people who might be considered for the position. And Pauline Adams was on the committee at that time. And she asked, I said, how did this come? Oh, she said, I think I got a letter from the chairman of the Committee on Faculty Affairs. Would I send a resume to them? And I said, thought to myself, what the hell, they would never appoint me. I wouldn't appoint myself based on my public persona, you know. I would appoint myself based on what I think of myself, but not that the other way. So I wasn't going to respond. But she said, or she or somebody said, look, you've got to respond. They might actually choose you. So I sent in a resume. And then I got a notice that there was going to be a meeting of the committee to which various people would be invited who were candidates or potential candidates for the job. I wasn't going to go to that either, but I did. And because I was convinced they wouldn't appoint me, I took, you know, it acted as if I wasn't eager to get the position. Well, it turned out that made a good impression on them, so they recommended me. So they sent my name up to President Wharton, and I forget the name of the provost that time. Oh, I think it was a guy named Boger from Ag.
Larry Boger.
Larry Boger. Pretty far off to the right of center, if I remember correctly. And he didn't think my columns were funny at all. I remember one time, and it must have been before this FGO thing came up, I poked fun at the idea of Michigan State. You know, Michigan State and Cornell have big ag colleges. Mm-hmm. And either, I think Michigan State had developed a cabbage which was green. And I said, for Christ's sake, waste your time doing that. It's silly. So I poked fun at that in the column. I think that got under Boger's skin. Anyway, what happened was the committee recommended me for the job. So Hortman Boger didn't want to appoint me. So they met with the committee and they said, we want you to submit three names. We'll pick one. The committee got their backs up, probably the only time in the history of that committee they ever did. I used to think of it as a do-nothing committee. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they said, no, the way we read this document, we're charged with making a recommendation and you're charged with appointing that person. Well, I think 3 months went by with nobody in the job, and there were, I think, two editorials in the State News. Why is the administration dragging its feet when LaRue has been recommended and he'd be an ideal grievance officer? Nothing happened. Well, then Wharton appointed a provost intern, and I think it might have been Chitra Smith, if I'm not mistaken, of political science, to go around to deans and department heads and ask them, could you work with LaRue if he's appointed as FGO? Because a big part of your job is to try to mediate disputes between administrators and the faculty. Could you work with him? And so she made a report back to him, and they called me over to the president's office. And they said, you're aware, of course, that your name has been put up for FGO, and we've been delaying action on it. And one of the things we did was to have this survey done. And what what was reported to us was that administrators who have never met you say, no, I couldn't work with him. The guy's crazy. But people who have actually worked with you, where you were representing somebody and informally, because or through the grievance procedure, mm-hmm. say you're perfectly practical and sensible, and they could work with you. So on the strength of this second set of responses, we're going to appoint you. And then they said, of course, you'll have to give up writing your column. I said, then forget it. So they said, okay, but you can't use anything in the column which you could only learn from a grievance, because you're supposed to keep those things confidential. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. Then they said, and of course you wouldn't be teaching. And I said, well, that's another reason you're going to have to find somebody else, because I don't like giving up teaching. What I, to be truthful about it, I didn't want to leave the department for 5 years, mm-hmm. and then come back and nobody would know me.
It was a 5-year assignment?
Put me through a test, you know, do you know enough economics to teach beginning economics? I think that's the real motivation, but I enjoyed teaching anyway. So they said, well, you can teach one course. Mm-hmm. Well, at the end of that, I think it was the end of the first year, see, the grievance officer is in the president's office, in the table of organization, mm-hmm. as is the ombudsman. But because I was teaching in the business school, the econ being in the business school, when the president's office made a recommendation for a salary increase, it went over to the dean in the business school for his confirmation or approval or whatever. And this guy wanted the increase to be less than the president's office was recommending. And he explained to the administrative assistant, a guy named Ballard, Al Ballard at the time, he was negotiating all this for the president. If we give LaRue this kind of an increase, and we do that for 5 years, he's going to come back into the college with a salary that's a lot higher than he deserves. So I think that was resolved in the favor of the president's recommendation. But it confirmed my suspicion that I wasn't high up on the dean's list of approved faculty.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you end up as FGO?
I had two terms in the grievance office. Mm-hmm. The first, after I was appointed in 76, Mackey came on in 1980, and it was evident to me that he had no use for a really meaningful grievance procedure. He proposed an alternative to it, and it was so bad, I resigned. Mm-hmm. I said, I can't work with a guy who disagrees as much as he and I do over how to run a grievance procedure. Mm-hmm. And while that was going on, I happened to be down in Lubbock, Texas for some day. Oh, I had, my son was a cop in Texas, and I went down to visit him. And I think he picked me up in Lubbock at the airport there. And we had to wait a while for some reason. So I thought, why don't I go over to whatever that Texas University
Texas Tech.
Is, Texas mm-hmm. Tech, where Mackey had been president. And I go over there and see what these guys think of what kind of a president he was. So I went over there and I sought out the president of the Faculty Senate, I think it was. And he said, you guys, something to the effect that our gain was your loss when you got a hold of it.